am half of Copy. This is Charlotte, who's the other half of Copy. We're currently in residence here at Site Gallery as part of Print It. Print It is made up of three parts: this exhibition of Coracle's work, and the bookshop that Site's put on, which is a brilliant pop-up artist bookshop. So do take a visit there if you've not been already. And our residency, and as part of our residency, we've programmed lots of exciting events. There's a few of these kicking around, and we're going to print out some more, but this is basically everything that we programmed as part of our residency to try and kind of bring the exhibition alive and bring some kind of dialogue with our own work and our own practice and that of the Coracle exhibition. So we're holding, as part of this programme, four discussions over Saturday, brunch, so I hope you've all helped yourself to coffee and tea and maybe some melon and croissant. And this is the second one. Today we're talking about fictions. So the talks are papers, fiction, scripts and circles. Just to give you a little bit of background, I guess, on myself and Charlotte, we're an artist publishing platform. We're really interested in how the written word kind of interacts with both performance, the live event, but also visual art and art in general. We've got our own practices. Mine's more writing-based, Charlotte's visual arts and writing. And we worked together to put publications together. Our first one was on a photocopier like a few years ago, and since then we've worked with Dust and digital printing to print a couple of publications. So we're kind of right at the start of this exciting adventure into print. But yeah, today we'd like to talk about fictions. Just the discussion as well to point out, the discussion from last week, papers, for those that weren't here, will be going as kind of an audio podcast online. So if you missed that, then it should be on our website next week, so check it out. I'll just hand over to Charlotte, who's going to introduce today's topic.
Okay, so today we are very lucky to have Tamara Norwood, Jennifer Hodgson, Jamie Crew, and... Alan Rowlands wasn't able to attend, so he's worked that into his contribution and sent an epistolatory text to be kind of ventriloquized by people here. So it works his absence and the sort of notion of the voice into the presentation. So we're going to be doing a reading to start things off. So in fictions, we're interested in how fiction kind of intersects, or writing in general intersects, with the contemporary art world and how the histories of both kind of work together, but also looking particularly at the nature of fiction and its kind of tension with fact and history and ideas of storytelling and narration within kind of art and performance practices. And so we've got lots of different perspectives that are going to be coming in. We're going to listen to all the presentations first, and then we'll be opening up to a kind of conversation where people bring in questions and we'll chair to an extent. So yeah, if we start by reading. So we've invited Tamarin and Jamie to join us, and we're just going to be reading a series of letters, and this is forms Alan Rowland's contribution to the talk. Okay. Dear Joanna, my apologies, but for reasons that seem to me, at least, rather passably sane and fair, I found it best, by far, not to read scripts or books that come in the mail. Years and years ago, I did have a short go at responding to gestures of the kind, but it led to complications that I couldn't manage. JDS.
Dear Miss Morgan, although you do not know me, my name is Donald. I have seized your name from the telephone book in an attempt to enmesh you in my concerns. We suffer today, I believe, from a lack of connection with each other. That is common knowledge. So common, in fact, that it may not even be true. It may be that we are over-connected, for all I know. However, I am acting on the first assumption that we are under-connected, and thus have flung you these lines, which you may grasp or let fall as you will. But I feel that if you neglect them, you will suffer for it. This is merely my private opinion. No police power supports it. I have no means of punishing you, Miss Morgan, for not listening, for having a closed heart. There is no punishment for that in our society. Not yet. But to the point, you and I, Miss Morgan, are not in the same universe of discourse. You may have not been aware of it previously, but the fact of the matter is that we are not. We exist in different universes of discourse. Now, it may have appeared to you, prior to your receipt of this letter, that the universe of discourse in which you existed and put it about was in all ways adequate and satisfactory. It may never have crossed your mind to think that other universes of discourse, distinct from your own, existed, with people in them discoursing. You may have, in a common sense way, regarded your U of D as a plenum, filled to the brim with discourse. You may have felt that what already existed was sufficient. People like you often do. This is certainly one way of regarding it, if a fat, self-satisfied complacency is your aim. But I say unto you, Miss Morgan, that even a plenum can leak, even a plenum can be penetrated. New things can rush, and displacing old things, things that were formerly there. No man's, Miss Plenum, Miss Morgan, is impervious to the all of God's will. Consider then your situation now. You are sitting there in your house with your fine dog, doubtless, and your handsome partner, conceivably, and who knows, with your gun-coloured car in the driveway, and opinions passing back and forth about whether they should build a new meeting hall or not, whether the children should become Thomists or not, whether the pump needs more cup grease or not. A comfortable scene, but I, Donald, am in possession of your telephone number, Miss Morgan. Think what that means. It means that at any moment I can pierce your plenum with a single phone call, simply by dialing. You are correct, Miss Morgan, in seeing this as a threatening situation. The moment I inject discourse from my U of D into your U of D, the yourness of yours is diluted. The more I inject, the more you dilute. Soon you will be presiding over an empty plenum, or rather, since that is a contradiction in terms, over a former plenum, in terms of yoursness. You are essentially in my power. I suggest an unlisted number. Yours faithfully, DB.
Dear novel, the fear of failing to reach the other, the fear of the failure of writing, as well as the hope that reading implies an understanding, that the meaning is conveyed to the other, are characteristic for the process of writing letters. The choice of this communication media evokes memories of the past, when humans had to rely on it if they wanted to get in touch with a remote person. However, unlike one might assume, the letter does not constitute a particular special case of communication. With regard to the constellation of those involved in the communication process, a letter can be seen as an example of communication itself. If it is assured that one structural characteristic of any message is the need to cover a distance, what is evident here is the way from one to the other, as well as the delayed arrival, which, in terms of an awareness of distances and the relationship from the time of writing to the spatial absence of the addressee, is intrinsic to the moment of writing. Thus, the following considerations also deal with language as a means of exchange, and with the process of exchange itself. If one examines the situation of the sender with regard to the uncertainty of his words, if his words will be received and understood, the letter gives an idea how the situation can be handled using an active approach instead of perceiving the absence of the addressee as a deficiency. In fact, it is this particular experience of emptiness that gives cause to write and provide space for indeterminate movement. Do all comments emerge for the sake of their communicability with relation to a potential addressee? For an exchange of letters, the possibility of a response is strictly indispensable. A letter originates because there is someone who is not at the same place as oneself, but who can be thought of and who is addressed by trying to write to her. However, this writing is not like spoken language that can be put into written language. The written form emphasises the conveyance of the message, and the situation of thought changes when the text itself comes to the fore. The dialogue is inevitably limited to one person. You and I are embodied by the same person, insofar as the answer has to be imagined and the addressee becomes fictional. This leads to a soliloquy that has always been initiated by the other.
Dear captives of the zoo, books are thick letters written to friends. Their telecommunication in medium print to underwrite friendship. Ever since philosophy began as a literary genre, it has recruited adherents by writing in an infectious way about love and friendship. Not only is it about the love of wisdom, it is also an attempt move others to this love, its capacity to make friends through its texts. It has been reinscribed like a chain letter through the generalizations, and despite all the errors of reproduction, indeed perhaps because of such errors, it has recruited its copyists and interpreters into the ranks of its brotherhood. If we consider the epical results of mail, it becomes evident that it has a particular relationship to the writing, sending, and receipt of philosophical writing. Apparently, the writer of this type of love letter sends his work out into the world without knowing the recipient. Or even if he knows him, he is conscious that the transmission transcends him and might provoke an unknown number of chances of friendship of the writer of books and letters with nameless, perhaps even yet unborn readers. Erotically seen, the hypothetical friendship of the writer of books and letters with the recipients of his messages represents a case of love at a distance. And this entirely in the sense of knowing that writing is in the power to transmit love not only to our nearest and dearest, but also through the next person encountered into the unknown, distant future life. Writing creates not only a telecommunicative bridge between known friends, who at the time of transmission live in geographical proximity to one another, but it sets in motion an unpredictable process. It shoots an arrow into the air with the objective of revealing an unknown friend and enticing him into the circle of friends. In fact, the reader who sits down to a thick book can approach it as an invitation to a gathering, and should she be moved by the contents, she thereby enters into the circle of the called, making herself available to receive the message. Letters that are not mailed cease to be missing for possible friends. They turn into archived things. Thus this, that the most important books of the past have more and more ceased to be letters to friends, and that they do not lie any longer on tables and nightstands of their readers, this has deprived the movement of its previous power. Less and less often do archivists climb up to the ancient texts in order to reference earlier statements of modern commonplaces. Perhaps it occasionally happens that in such research, in the dead cellars of culture, the long-ignored texts begin to glimmer, as if a distant light flickers over them. Can the archives also come into the clearing? Everything suggests that archivists have become the successors. For the few who still peer around into those archives, the realization is dawning that our lives are the confused answer to questions which we were asked in places we have forgotten. Yours, P.S.
Postscript. If the fate of particular books demonstrates anything, it is that books, texts, essays, open letters also, and sometimes much more easily, make enemies. And this is not necessarily a bad thing. Why, it may well be a good thing, in fact. Enmity, rather than friendship, we dare to venture, ultimately ensures the health of all thinking and writing. We have said elsewhere, but where exactly in our robust body of collected writing, that the history of art should, or at least could, one day be recounted from the perspective of its being a history in the final analysis of friendship, if not love affairs. If that happy day will ever come to pass, however a riposte, yours, dear copy, will inevitably invite itself in the shape of history and hostilities of enmities, and so we long for the return of revival of truly vitriolic letter writing. The salutary, liberating obliqueness of letter writing, the intimacy of correspondence, is really an exercise in distancing. Let us imagine such obliqueness to be present, potentially, in all writing. Its traces move in neither perpendicular nor parallel a fashion, but away, diverging, bifurcating, always already becoming out of sight. The letter writer, however directly he or she may be addressing the letter reader, is always destined to become a speck on the latter's horizon, growing ever more distant, signing each letter with a baleful farewell. And supposing we never meet again, this letter better be damn well written.
October 21st, 1962. Dear Joanna and Charlotte, I must tell you first, off-puttingly or no, that I am at best a one-shot letter writer these days. Along with that, I really never have anything to say when I'm done writing fiction at the end of the day. One thought, and one only, hits me about your letter. Entirely materialistic, I'm afraid. You need a new typewriter ribbon. Get one or don't get one, but unless you make an effort to deal with things as unabstractedly as that, you're stewing quite unnecessarily. You've decided that things are what matter to people. Of course. Not only with people, but with you too. Everything in your letter is a thing, concrete or abstract. Avidya and Vidya are things. For me, before anything else, you're young women who need a new typewriter ribbon. See that fact and don't attach more significance to it than it deserves, and then get on with the rest of your day. Good wishes to you, JDS.
And that is what we're going to read of Alan's contribution. So we'll move
straight on to Jamie Crew. We're just going to be showing a video. So we'll just, if we can hand the lights off. Cool. So I've written something, so I hope you don't mind me continuing to read stuff off a piece of paper. But it's been, the project is kind of an ongoing thing that started a few years ago. So when I was thinking about how to present it, it was weird to kind of like backtrack from my current thinking to like the originating thinking of the project. So I thought I'm going to have to write this down, but that's kind of encountered in the text anyway. So Bomarzo is a film I'm currently working on, and a film I made in 2009, and an opera by Alberto Ginastera, and a novel by Emanuele Mujica Lange, and a town in Lazio, central Italy, and the villa located there, and the sculpture garden that surrounds it. By which I mean Bomarzo is an adaptation, part of a continuing line of adaptations. I first began working on this project in 2009 when I decided to adapt Ginastera's opera into a short film. The libretto of the opera was written by the Argentine author and critic Manuel Mujica Lanez, based on the novel of the same name, and both were inspired by the life of the 16th century Duke Pier Francesco Orsini, and the sculpture garden he built in Bomarzo, his ancestral seat in Lazio. The garden is a tourist attraction today and known as the Wood of Monsters to locals, filled as it is with unnerving figures such as a pair of warring giants, or Hercules or Orlando, dogs attacking a dragon, a giant roaring face with a mouth big enough to step inside, or the mouth of hell or an orc, an echidna, a pegasus, Glaucus or Proteus, and more. The identities of the figures are almost as contested as their intent and significance. The garden's been posited as a mannerist spectacle, slyly contradicting the polite conventions of Renaissance landscaping with its scattered order and ghastly inhabitants. It's been viewed as a scholarly work, with the sculptures connected to literary figures from antiquity onwards, the work of a highly read man who was also a soldier and perhaps a hunchback. It's been read as pure folly, as one of its abstruse inscriptions says, solvus vagari licore, which means just to let the heart run free. And it's also been interpreted as a memorial to Orsini's wife, Giulia Fanesi. Mujica Lainez's novel imagines the sculptures as allegories, representative of events in Orsini's life charged with subjective fiction. So I will play you a little clip of my 2009. So, my first Bomarzo indulges these fictions. It is an adaptation of an opera adapted from a novel inspired by history. Each stage and each contributor twists, converts, and specializes the story, forming it around the conventions of their medium and their agendas as author. However, in some senses, my Bomarzo is incomplete. I wrote a script and drafted a storyboard, but the film was shot on miniature model sets with no actors. The camera follows the storyboarded beats of the script, cutting between characters and dialogue, but there are no characters and nobody speaks. The score reacts to moments of drama, but no such moments take place on screen. The sets are flat and the decorations are painted. They're structures of artifice, of appearance, which suggests the hollowness of mind.
Just wait a minute.
we had these.
So yeah, with this film, the system of adaptation is continued, but undercut. The characters, rooted in history but altered by fiction, disappear altogether. The impossibility of representation is made absurdly literal, and the unknowability of history is taken to the point of narrative collapse. The fantasias on the documented past that form Mojica Lanez's novel are extrapolated upon in the opera and embellished in the script and planning of the film. But the characters are snatched back at the point of execution. We are left with the formal, structural qualities of film: ordered shots, backdrops, music cues, titles and props, but no action and no representation. The fiction doesn't happen. The film was accompanied by three books, three black and white facsimiles, one of the libretto of Ginastera's opera, one of Mojica Lanez's novel, and one of a more practical guide to the sculpture garden. Each of these was limited to the first 18 pages, the same length as my unused and unacted script. As well as providing context for the work, these books bore the mark of an adaptation turning against its originating material. They were arrested by their own future. They were reproductions, subtle deviations, new forms, which were unfinished, curtailed, without satisfaction or resolution. And so,
I'll show you this.
So this is some test shots for my new version of the Marzo, because I'm refilming it and I've readapted it. And this new version of the Marzo, which I'm working on now, adapts from the previous film. The script moves much further away from Mojica Lanez's contributions, stripping back the cast and action, and focusing on poison to delirium as a narrative tool, and subverting the Duke's dominion of the story, allowing one or two of his voiceless accessories to speak and ultimately exceed him. You won't see any of this, however, when it's filmed. Sets and props, this time based entirely on the printed reproductions of Bomarzo's sculptures, local trees, and appropriate materials, will be standing still. You can see that's an actual picture of one of the sculptures this time. The camera will follow no one through the woods. A new, entirely a cappella and improvised score will be recorded, and will be the only thing. The Garden of Bomarzo was executed in a mannerist style, a movement which favoured artificiality and intellectual references above the preceding naturalistic approaches, and I share these priorities in my approach. Each epoch is a response to what has come before it, and these oscillations of style are part of their own historical chain of action and reaction. Each form of the story reacts to the previous one, and I intend to keep it going, creating the work's own history, which will slowly obscure and distort even my own originating impulses. So yeah, that's my text, and yeah, as you can see, it's reaching that point where the project is starting to have its own history and its own kind of deviations, where the kind of first idea that starts off is then getting more and more twisted and indistinct and different. So yeah, thanks very much.
Thanks, Jamie. I think we'll move straight on, and then we'll save up all our questions. We're keeping them closed for time, and then we'll open them again. Thanks.
So my interest in fiction, I work as an artist and writer, and I'm not quite sure when I'm doing art, when I'm doing writing, but my interest in fiction is kind of in the brink of fiction, the brink of when you're sort of between fiction and reality, and what happens when you're the point, maybe if we could find a meeting point between the two. And I'm imagining this in kind of a formal material sense, when those two things kind of physically meet, and also in more of a sort of conceptual sense of
who's authoring whom in a fiction. So can I just have my
that.
Yeah, I wanted to just start by reading a short two paragraphs from a text that I've written. I want to show you a bit of a text and various some videos, a couple of performances, things like that. I'm going to try to squeeze into 10 minutes. I'm just going to read you a couple of paragraphs. This is one attempt at my trying to find a meeting point between a fictional world and a non-fictional world, but in text. The author turns her pen in her fingertips and dabs the nib against her tongue. She holds it still for a second or two until the coldness gives way to taste and she feels it salty and lightly acrid. She brings the wet nib to the page and writes until the line returns to full opacity. The semi-opaque words begin to describe the left nipple of O, which in the present prose is tight with the attention of the sharp and cold nib. She favours cursive script for its continuous contact with the page and its long and sweeping descenders, for curving into subsequent letters and even, lazily, into subsequent words. She writes lazily. Each word lingers on the page until the next begins, their pauses filling with slow curves of ink as the pen resists leaving the surface of the page until it inscribes into view every inch of the undressed skin. These close attentions are marked on the body of the protagonist for minutes on end in the wordless sensation of being particularly there. She feels neither heat nor swelling, but a kind of fullness that causes her skin to linger in mind for reasons beyond her. She thinks of the words, beyond me. The author pauses her protagonist in soft-lit rooms for their encounters. And as her caresses begin, she softens the texture of the walls and causes her to barely breathe. In these moments of stillness, the author wants to be still too and commune with O as lovers do in pauses. She pauses the nib against the page mid-word in the thick of the letter I of sigh. She holds her lover's breath in her fingertips and closes her eyes to exhale with her, but as the pen stops, O drops out of sight, temporarily unwritten. Alone suddenly, she opens her eyes and leans over the paper to watch the grain absorb the ink and holds until it saturates the ground around it. When finally she moves the nib, it wades through a trough of black and dislodges the fibres, pulling an empty hole into the page. She cannot cause the passing of their times to correspond. So it's an ongoing story about the problem of trying to make a protagonist and her fictional character try to meet in some way, and the problem of the temporalities of writing and being written. When you're writing, time is passing, and in a fiction, time is passing, in the narrative, but trying to get those two things to coordinate so that both can be still at once or both can be moving at once provokes these terrible problems. If you pause the moment of writing, the narrative stops. You can't do it. So there's this, believe me, that's a sort of a text. There's a sort of visual attempt I've made at this as well, which is, this is one page of a sort of 30 or 40 pages, turnabout line. It's an attempt to write to the line that I'm writing, and this attempt to get the line to turn around and be spoken to somehow. And this sadness that you can't lift your pen from the page because otherwise the line will stop and you'll lose contact with this kind of thing that you're writing this love song to or something. And there's this feeling that afterwards, once the line is kind of dead and on the page, then you'll come afterwards and dot the I's and cross the T's, but it's already gone, But it's not even finished before you'd finished it, So that's a very sort of sad thing. Now, there's various themes emerge from this idea of the problem of trying to make a tech, a narrative, and a fictional narrative and the world that's creating it correspond at certain moments. One of these themes, which is what this video relates to, and I think there is a sound. It's fine. This is a piece of work which I've developed, and that's Anthony Whedon, he's an orchestra conductor. This is a performance which has been staged at Tate Britain, here at Modern Art Oxford, this is at the Bodleian and Library Courts, on the South Bank as well, and at SEA Gallery in London. Seems to keep happening. He's conducting the movements of what's happening around him. And at times, it's not clear who's conducting whom, because the people who are observing him kind of are the score. They're also the music, they're the musicians, they're the instruments, but they're also the audience. But then sometimes he's the audience. You know, there's a real ambiguity about it. Because sometimes somebody will jump into a dance or something like that. You can see he's capturing the moment where he takes, where she takes the picture. I've got a video of him at the Southland Club, which I'll show you. This, you can scroll through this just to see. We put him in a number of locations. It was interesting choosing his locations because he needed to have good sight points. You know, he needed to be able to see traffic, bikes. So there's a range of, you know. It's a bit weird when people clap. A bit weird. Anyway, so that's him at Montmartre, which was just this year. This is him at the South Bank. You can see what he's doing now. He's just conducting the movement of the boat, which you can see in the reflection. That was the boat he's just... And in, I think in a moment there's some roadworks which he captures. And it was at this point that a group of lads, I think they were on a sort of stag night or something, they were all really good singers. I got the impression that they were a Welsh choir on a stag night. That's just the feeling I got. But they all stopped in front of him, saw what was going on, burst into song. And so he started conducting them, speeding them up, so, which is brilliant. So really, it really was ambiguous who was authoring who, you know. And this is him at Tate Britain. You can see that people were really crowding round and trying to catch him. And a couple of girls stood behind him and sped in front of him to see whether he was fast enough. And he was, because that's his job. He's conducting a hug. We think they'll get a hug anyway. This is me, this is sped up, this is double speed. This is me, this is Alex Noah, who's a deaf actor. I was interested in where language and non-language can meet. He's describing very onomatopoeically the movements I'm making with my hands to create this wire shape. It's sped up just because it makes it very difficult to read if you understand BSL, but it just makes it clear how symmetrical our actions are. So he's in language, I'm not in language, I'm in the world. But you can see how our movements are very, very meet very much. Which I think has something to do with moving from fiction to non-fiction. Not that language is somehow fictional, but it does operate in a different space in the room. Famously pointing in sign language. You know how a little child will mix up deaxis? They'll point, they'll say you when they mean me because they're referred to as you. And a deaf child learning sign language will point to themselves when they mean to point to their mother or somebody because they're referred to, the mother is referred to with a point to herself. So pointing isn't in the room when it's in language in the way the pointing is in the room when we just point, you know. This was a commission for the London Word Festival 2010, I think, and it was performed at the Rich Mix. You can see what I love, sometimes he will take the wire as well, and when his hands, which are using language, are holding the thing of wire, what on earth linguistically could this be? I mean, that's kind of I don't know if that's having a lisp or something, but I find that very interesting. Now, another strand, I just want to, wait, stop. Pretend you didn't see that. Be delighted again. So one of the strands coming out of my interest in where fiction and non-fiction meet is this, what you've just seen, that the kind of ambiguity about authorship, who's authoring who, the possibility that somehow the fictional thing is authoring the non-fiction or vice versa, some kind of ambiguity there, which I think those two projects sort of mess around a little bit. And another interest, another kind of strand that comes out of this trying to make fiction and non-fiction meet is the very physical moment of writing, the procedure of writing, which came out in the text which I read, where the if you hold the pen still, it blocks the page and actually digs a hole into the page. So you can start again. It's only about 30 seconds long. Oh, no. That's bad. Sorry. Stop. I just like the way that this is a kind of performance of the pens, isn't it? You know, they're kind of on a stage. The camera stays still and the lines emerge, but really it's not about the lines that are coming out, it's about the time that the lines are spent being created, you know, the time spent creating the lines, the movements of the pens, which become kind of like characters on the stage. And the thing that you're left with, the scribble on the page, is really irrelevant. I haven't kept that. That's... result of a drawing process or a writing process might not really be the crucial thing. You know, maybe it's the process that's important, the time in which you spend writing or drawing. Maybe that's the work. And what's left over, I mean, the residue of a text, the residue of writing is a piece of writing, but that's really quite different from the temporal experience or the moment or the materiality of the writing process. So that was mainly just because I got a new thing of felt tips, and you have to always have to test out your pens when you get them. This was a commission from Modern Art Oxford. Oh no, this isn't, sorry. Pause music and still be listening to it, you know? You can't pause music and, in the same way that you can't pause a moment of writing and sort of be within the paused narrative. And this was just a kind of attempt to see what would happen, you know, just experiment with various ways of presenting text that would reflect the idea that you can't somehow pause the time of writing. In the end, what you don't get here is a kind of calm stillness. You actually get a kind of frantic performance of reason. In the same way that maybe that was a performance of writing, I don't know. I think those kind of those two things kind of partner one another somehow. But anyway, that's just a kind of experiment which I threw in. The next thing I'm going to show you is a commission for Modern Arts, which very much followed up from the felt tip pens. It's called Keeping Time, and the video I'm going to show you is actually a split screen video, but it was originally shown in Modern Art as two screens, a kind of video installation on two big screens facing each other in the room. So here's that. And it feels like they're kind of having a conversation or dancing or something like that. And again, it's very much the time they spend, the order in which they make these movements, the speed at which they make these movements that creates a dialogue between them. And the images or texts that result really are not part of the conversation. They're really kind of excesses or residues, you know, that you get rid of. The way I made it, in case you're interested, is I had some tracing paper on top of some glass and a pen and a curly tripod with the camera mounted below the pen so they'd come to, following a lot of trial and error, a lot of horrible trial and error. So that's that. And then this is the last thing I want to show you. The following on from that sort of residency at Modern Art Oxford, I was asked to make a book that would kind of pull together some of the ideas. And so this is me making the book. My idea was that trying to get a situation where you could be drawing or writing as an act of reading somehow. And what would happen if you tried to make the turning of the pages into part of the reading or writing process. It sounds very stupidly abstract, but what I eventually made was a book that pivots. This is obviously a rough, but a book that pivots. And what happens is, well, I can show you a little video. I'll show you a video and maybe you'll understand. This is them arriving. They were published by Modern Art and produced by Bookworks Studio. They did a fantastic job. Actually, I'll show you. I've got a few of these. Is it worth just flinging these around while I play a little video of them at work? If you pass that on further on, then you can get a head start. This is the book kind of all opened out. This is the finished book. And here's a video to show you how it kind of works. It's vaguely absurd doing an instructional video for a book, because you can't. But no, this isn't an instructional video. There's actually a little card of instructions inside the book showing how to do it, which has diagrams. But you can see what you're doing is is you're moving the pages around the pencil. So you create your, it's as though the pencil's making a kind of geometric journey, movement around. It's called a guidebook for pencil and paper. And so you make all these movements, and every page is different, you know. But then what you're left with at the end is just a dot. There, I'll end on that. That's the end. Oh, but I'll just say that these books, they're actually mock-up. They're actually, unfortunately, they were the first set of them was wrong. There'd been a misprint, basically. One of the holes didn't line up, and we needed to get them all reprinted.
Oh, no.
It was Bookworks who had done a fantastic job, but unfortunately, somehow they decided to erase a hole and put it back in, and it didn't work. The pivot didn't work. So I had to phone and say, "I'm sorry, it doesn't. You have to do them all again." And so they did them all again, very graciously and brilliantly and swiftly, and very happy with them. But these, as a result, these don't work. They're just about a millimetre off on various pages, you can imagine. So we couldn't sell them. So you can't really play with these. And also what's missing from them is that last white page where the dot would turn up. So, you know. But the new ones are in the shop. They're in the modern art Oxford shop, and they're all done and they work. So it's good. Thank you.
Interloper here today because I definitely am not an artist, and neither do I work in this kind of uncertain space between art and literature. I am an academic researcher of British experimental fiction from the 60s, and I am a literary editor at an international publishing house, not-for-profit publishing house of experimental fiction and novels in translation, called Dalkey Archive Press. And as a result, I spend a lot of my life reading books and thinking about books that no one read at the time and no one has wanted to read since. So I'm not really used to anyone taking an interest. However, and I'm fine, thanks. I'm fine with that, I'm an academic, we're all used to it. But this weird thing has been happening to me recently, where I've been getting all these emails from like art people, and they all want to talk about my work. And I'm amazed by this because, like, frankly, the book world and academia couldn't care less. So this really set me thinking. And when these chaps asked me to come and speak today, I was like, it's proof I have a home in the art world. They want me. So I'm delighted to be among such friendly company. And this is more than the number that's ever turned up to one of my academic panels, where 2.5 people to hear me speak about B.S. Johnson. Okay, so I want to talk a bit today about this thing of art being interested in experimental fiction. I want to sort of hazard a kind of diagnosis of there being something happening, particularly now, of that being a kind of ongoing thing, but try and work out why that's happening now. But as a literary person on this side of the fence, I want to kind of look at it from a literary perspective. Because I think the idea of there being a kind of dialogue between literature and art is, of course, nothing new, and it's always been a kind of mutually advantageous thing. Experimental fiction, especially in Britain, is often a euphemism for writers with a narcissistic personality disorder, fiction that doesn't sell. But that may be, but experimental fiction has always had recourse to the visual arts. There's always been the sense amongst people that write experimental fiction and people that are interested in experimental fiction that the language and the formal convention, the linear narrative, and even the actual codex-bound printed book itself is not really up to the task, that writers are labouring with imperfect tools. And to try and counter this, they've turned to the visual arts, to try and replicate some of its aesthetic effects and affects. They've used the artistic imagination to try and escape the comfortably quotidian world of real life and to access the parts of human experience that verbal cannot reach. When we think about the cross currents between literature and visual art, the first thing we think about might be what I call the isms. That's surrealism, futurism, vorticism, etc. These movements in art and literature that kind of coalesced and later became known as modernism that happened in the early decades of the 20th century. For lots of people, this period of a kind of like tremendous outpouring of creative energy is really the high point of experimental fiction. And everything that happened since has been a bit of a letdown. The point of my research and the point of my work in publishing is really to argue that actually the novel has this kind of engagement with the visual. The novel has this kind of experimental kind of impulse inbuilt into its very form. If you read the textbooks or if you take my Introduction to Novel 101 course at Durham University, I have to tell you that the novel began in the 18th century with the classic realist works of people like Daniel Defoe, Henry Fielding and Samuel Richardson. And we're talking about novels like Robinson Crusoe, Clarissa and Tom Jones. But those of a more experimental bent, like myself, might perhaps choose to locate a kind of originator for an alternative tradition of the novel in a book like Tristram Shandy by Lawrence Stern, in Tristram Shandy is dealing with a lot of the kind of impossibilities, the paradoxes, the problems that Tamarin was just speaking about. Tristram Shandy makes a very extensive use of visual and typographical elements in the attempt to communicate what literary language cannot. But we've also got someone like J.G. Ballard, who is very much a kind of legatee of what happened earlier, of surrealism, of modernism, and also of works like Tristram Shandy. He wrote novels, well, he was a kind of, also a kind of like literary outsider. He kind of railed against a literary culture that he found to be tremendously provincial and kind of backward. And he really found a home in the art world during the 60s. His novels really aspired to be something like art. They used the kinds of devices that we ordinarily associate with the visual, things like montage, collage, and jump cut. His idea was that his novels should be looked at rather than read. And they, at their most experimental, I'm thinking of books like The Atrocity Exhibition. He has also written kind of more mainstream novels. But things like The Atrocity Exhibition really act to break, I mean, I guess break the frame of what we understand as literary or literature. Ballard sits in a kind of space somewhere in between art and literature, in a kind of like in-between space, an interstitial space, I guess, where he's often most comfortable. Or if we're thinking again about the ways in which the book has used the visual, we might come to think of writers who have shown some appreciation or tried to explore the idea that the book is also an art object. What they're doing there is really breaking the illusion that happens when we open a book. There's this thing that happens where we go to chapter one, page one, and we enter a fictional world almost as if nothing is happening or nothing has changed here. So we have those books that draw attention to the physical fact of the book, that draw attention to the fact that there is a gate, you are entering a fictional world, and beware. And here I might think of something like B.S. Johnson's The Unfortunates, which is a fairly infamous one. It's a book in a box. It's 27 loose-leaf chapters, with the first and the last ones that you read specified, but the rest can be read in any order. It always reminds me of, do you remember Choose Your Own Adventure stories that you read as a kid? It's like that. It's like that, but for kind of grown-ups. But what has happened recently, and what I think all these people from the Royal College of Art that keep emailing me, is, which is lovely, is symptomatic of. There's something shifted in the relationship between visual art and literature recently, I think. And that was indicated to me by this little anecdote that I'm about to tell you, without mentioning any names. Because I work for a not-for-profit publisher, I spend lots of time emailing writers and asking them to do things for me for free. And often they tell me to bugger off, but sometimes they're more polite than this. One particular author, I was asking him to contribute, I won't mention his name, but he's kind of high profile, and I was asking him to write a kind of opinion piece on the British contemporary novel for a thing that we were working on. And he declined, but his email back was very interesting. He said to me, and I quote, "I'm not sure I have anything to say about British contemporary literature. I didn't know there was any. All the interesting stuff seems to be coming from the art world." And it's not just him. There are things circulating. There's a Guardian literary critic called Lee Rourke who pops up every now and again and champions the kind of books that I'm interested in, so I'm always delighted when he appears. And he published an article in 2008 in which he asks, "Ever wondered what happened to British avant-garde fiction?" And I think he's speaking to a kind of small audience there. But he continues, "Well, it seems to have found a home in London's conceptual art world." Now, I, as a student of experimental literature, or what I don't really like to call avant-garde literature, I would have some problems with that kind of statement. I would question whether such a thing as a British avant-garde novel has ever existed, actually. And also, I would question whether it's okay to use a term like avant-garde now, right? I mean, that's the topic of a whole different talk, and we haven't got time for that. But anyway, leaving that aside, what Lee Rourke and what my nameless author have commented upon, there's certainly some evidence for that. I'm thinking perhaps of the Samina book series, which was edited by a writer and artist called Stuart Hearn. It was brought up by Bookworks, who Tamarin mentioned, which is an independent art publisher. There's also Visual Editions, who are trying to do this thing where they draw together what's thought of as like the art book and the literary text. They've got a few recent things. One is a book called Kapow by Adam Thirlwell, which is kind of wild. And the other one is Jonathan Safran Foer's book, which is called Tree of Codes, which is kind of like, it's kind of sculptural in a way. They've also done a new edition of Tristram Shandy, which is very beautiful, and which is, you know, kind of the, I guess, the air text of this kind of tradition of what they're calling visual writing. There's also this chap, Tom McCarthy, who is a writer that's like all over the literary press now, and everyone thinks he's sort of like, he's going to like rejuvenate modernism for the 21st century, which I also have a problem with, but I will not go into now. McCarthy's an interesting one because he spent years trying to get his works published, and eventually he did, but he first emerged as an artist. He does this funny thing that I'm not really sure is whether it's parody or pastiche. It's called, he's the general secretary of a semi-fictitious organisation called the International Necronautical Society, which is all about death and things approaching nothingness. But it also sort of parodies or pastiches, not quite sure, the sorts of bureaucratic structures that are generally associated with, well, both the former Soviet Union and the kind of avant-garde of the early 20th century that we've already talked about. And there's loads more examples. But what interests me is in thinking about why experimental writing has found this kind of home in the art world. This thing of there being a crisis in the publishing industry, I mean, I don't even need to say it. It's when I sort of first started thinking about this stuff, I could still say that and it would sort of like be relevant, but now it's just not even worth thinking about, of course. The publishing industry is in crisis. It's terrible. The publishing industry has kind of been in crisis for a number of years in terms of there being a kind of like increasingly commercial book culture, stuff like, the idea of being subject to the bottom line of a kind of multinational corporate conglomerate that's come and eaten up your tiny press, or the chain bookshops, and all this sounds so irrelevant now, but chain bookshops, literary prize culture, all the kind of problems that publishers have been moaning about for the last 25 years. All of these really look like small fry in comparison to a thing that's happened recently, which people always refer to sort of like quietly as the Amazon problem. What's interesting about this kind of like relationship between digital media and fiction, and especially experimental fiction, is what was happening 20 years ago in the 90s, when people thought that what would happen with digital media is that the novel, as we knew it, would die. There'd be no more books. But what would also happen is that the novel would be kind of reborn as what is called hypertext fiction. People had this idea that although the physical book would die, it would have a kind of afterlife as a kind of crazy, ludic, labyrinthine thing online. And for some time in the 90s, this was thought to be a kind of like valid and successful and proper future for the book. It was actually going to happen. We were all going to be sort of like cyber hackers, like living in underground tunnels and communicating only by email. I mean, it was a kind of utopian time in the 90s with thinking about this stuff. But as we all know, what actually happened was really a lot more boring. unfortunately, there's still hope for hypertext. People are still saying that it might come back in 10 years when we're ready for it and stuff. But what actually happened was kind of e-readers, electronic ink, and this thing that's happened with stuff like Kindles, where you get an electronic device that sort of pretends to be a book, which just sort of looks like a book, encourages you to engage with it like a book, sort of tries to mimic the feel of paper and ink, and it's all very ghostly, and I feel a bit funny about it. And it's funny that this thing where literature sort of failed to grasp the nettle of the kind of limitless possibilities of digital technology, it was meant to produce these amazing, like, only online works, intangible online works. But it's interesting that literature's failure in that regard has sort of coincided with this thing that's happening in the art world, where art has suddenly got a lot more interested in books again. Art is suddenly sort of re-engaging with the idea of the artist's book. And I mean, I would hazard a guess as a rank outsider that it was in some way a response to digital media. It's the intangibility. It was trying to get back to something physical, but also kind of to do with how democratic books are. How they're a mass-produced object, you know. A novelist called Jonathan Franzen, who is another person that I have lots of problems with, he suggested that, he's written a lot about how foolish it is to be an experimental writer. He says that you kind of owe it to the medium of the novel to be as kind of commercial, in a sense, as possible. Like, he looks on experimental writing as kind of like hubris. And he argues that you need to safeguard the medium by writing the books that people want to read, basically, which is problematic in all kinds of ways. I think the problem with experimental literature is that it's, in a way, a victim of the book's success. As I've just said, the book is a kind of really perfect mass medium. And the publishing industry is very definitely a commercial enterprise. And it's not just a question of everything's gone bad over the last 20 years. Publishing has always been a deeply commercial thing, right? The development of the novel was brought about, is kind of inextricably linked to the rise of a literate middle class in the 18th century. So the publishing has always been commercial. Therefore, the kind of book culture has always been subject to the whim of the marketplace in a way that art isn't. Tom McCarthy, the novelist again, puts it like this. The UK art market is driven by no more than 50 very well-informed collectors, but every schmo is a book buyer. When lowest common denominator logic dictates editorial policy, bookshops fill up with the literary equivalent of Athena posters. I think in publishing there's often this sense, this like kind of nostalgic idea about there being some halcyon day, kind of previously, maybe 30 years ago, where publishing was sort of able to like cushion books that mattered from the whims of the market. And at first I just thought that, I really thought to myself that this was just like kind of grey-haired nostalgia. But it does seem to have been the case in some sense. You've got figures in the UK like John Calder, Marion Boyars, Tom Mashler, in the States you have people like Alfred Knopf and Horace Livewright. And they've become kind of like semi-mythical kind of maverick publishers who were kind of wild and had excellent parties in Soho. But what they also did was kind of safeguard what they thought of as good works from the kind of worst of the market. They were willing to publish things that won't sell because they liked them, which these days seems like a kind of incredible idea, really. Because these days, non-commercial publishers and the smaller presses and places like Dalkey that I work for, we rely on this funny sort of like modern system of patronage. The benevolence, the grace and favour of the Arts Council, benefactors, endowments, foundations, donors. The publishing company that I work for is based in America, which is a lot better at getting money in this way because I guess they have more practice in a way. But still, despite this kind of new reliance on public funding, book culture has never been funded to the same extent with the same generosity as art has. I think that's something to do with the fact that publishing sort of operates across these two very different levels. You know, it's simultaneously an absolutely commercial enterprise and also kind of decidedly not. So in closing, I'd sort of like to think a bit about what all this amounts to, because in a sense it's a question of same difference. Does it really matter if a work of experimental writing is published by an art press or if it's published by a literary press? If we can leave aside our kind of prejudices across the barricade between art and literature, isn't it all just kind of okay? Isn't art in a way offering kind of life raft to experimental fiction? I mean, what else would happen in these times? Shouldn't we be sort of like thanking and celebrating the art world for helping us out in that way? I feel a bit uneasy about it, in a way. I think that in as much as this new interest from the art world in literature, these emails that I keep getting is evidence of a kind of willingness for creative dialogue, which is, of course, always a good thing. What it makes me worry about is what we're doing wrong in book culture. It makes me worry about there being kind of problems within the book culture in the UK that and the ways in which it frames the production and reception of writing. And it also suggests to me these kind of real, ongoing, big, intractable problems that we have within book culture itself with nurturing fictional writing in Britain. And there I'll leave it.
Thank you. So I think we're going to take some questions, because I'm sure everybody's got a lot. Because there's not too many of us this week, it'd be really great if before you ask your question, if you can just maybe give us, if you'd like to, a little introduction into who you are and your own practice or what like
computing.
Just that everybody who are listening, you know, that it's not obligatory.
Yeah, it's not obligatory, you're just saying name for long, but we thought it'd be nice if you
what seemed to come up in Alan's work and in Jamie's and Tamara's is perhaps it's kind of like a retelling or a merging of these different spaces and histories and existing stories and, you know, kind of reconfiguring or representing, and all these rewords kept coming out, like unpacking and revisiting and putting things together in perhaps non-linear or sort of shifted ways that bring in the imaginary. And I don't know whether that's something that seems to tie in a lot with kind of experimental writing or different art practices throughout history, and perhaps is that the thing that unites writers and artists in their sort of role in dealing with this kind of material of history and the context of now, and it's always been there in experimental writing, you know, and then perhaps there's a lot of debate now about experimental writing has found a home within this art world because of the publishing industry, but it's always kind of, you know, maybe it always has intersected in that way, in a way that normal commercial novel writing might not have been a home for. Does that make sense in any way?
The point I put upon what you just said was like the intention. Maybe it'd be quite interesting to ask the panelists to background. Yeah, what is, why do you work in that way, I suppose, and why does your work involve fiction?
Yeah. Well, I'm always interested in that, the kind of Derridean idea of the chain of signifiers, and the idea that there's not an originating point, there's only a chain of subsequent interpretations, manifestations. And so I think it's interesting in terms of things like Tamara, your work, where it's kind of trying to catch that moment of synchronicity between what's written and what's experienced through writing. But there's always, it's the Derridean idea of there's always, no, it's not quite enough, it's not quite the language to address things. It's always in these kind of mediated states. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really like. I like the idea of everything being mediated and filtered through these different different kind of barriers to meaning. And what my interest is that there's no meaning to start with, there's only mediation. So that's always the kind of thing that gets me, and that's why in terms of experimental literature I'm not really taken by people like Eulipo, who were kind of mainly French group of writers in I guess the 50s and 60s, who did these really playful structural things where they would do various kind of games with existing texts. Was one of the things they did, where they would do these reordering things which were really counter-narrative. And another work, or a series of works I've done, is taking dream sequences from films and cutting them up word by word in the dialogue, and then rearranging them. One of them's alphabetically, one of them's by word length. So you kind of have like a very narrative scene and a kind of a very cinematic scene that kind of takes you on this linear journey through a mental space. But then you're doing something to it which completely ignores any sense of like narrative or even artistic intention. It's like, it's methodical. It's like, how many letters are there in this word? Well, then you're there, and then you're there. And so you actually get this product that's really kind of contrary. Like it's unfit for the original purpose, but through putting that kind of arbitrary rule on something, you can actually reveal something different, or something contrary, or something, I don't know. That's what really excites me about that kind of Eulipan approach. It's like playful, but it's actually really brutal as well. And yeah, it does things to texts that don't come through active authorial working, I guess. So yeah, that's a little bit what I'm interested in.
Go around. I think drawing together a couple of these things, I'm thinking about sort of
16th century salons, Paris salons with scatterhangs, where you have painting after painting after painting, they've all got their own frames, and it's not a problem because each frame designates a whole world, and at the end of the frame the world ends and there's no tension. Well, the point is that there's no tension. Certain painters then got involved in the tension, made tondoi and these kinds of things coming in and out and arranging, positioning things on walls in such a way that the frame enters into the rest of the room and so on. But that tension, I think, with the framing, what the frame does in a painting, has a long heritage in the visual arts. And I wonder, just thinking about why visual art has taken over, it seems, where literature's, whether when metafiction became the thing that everyone was doing, which is the thing I read was very much a metafiction. I thought, writing about the fact that you're writing, or trying to make the writing bleed out, like Donald Bartholdy, trying to make the writing bleed out into the real world. That was already going on in painting in, 60, that has a long history in painting. Mm. And I just wonder whether, with metaphor, it was maybe metaphor, where the attention is specifically drawn to the frame, or where there's the a warning, you're entering a fictional world now, or, this. I wonder whether that's the connection the visual art maybe thought.
I mean, what's interesting with the metafiction thing is that we tend to associate it with being a particularly kind of like 80s, 90s, like crazy, playful, postmodern thing. But actually, I mean, there are some people that say that like what we classify as like classic realism, sort of like realistic kind of quotidian style writing was itself a kind of blip. And that actually, I mean, my argument is always that the novel has always been self-conscious. The novel has always had a kind of like recognition of its own frame. And far more so in the beginnings of the novel when the genre was sort of still being solidified, because they had no idea what they were writing, yeah? So they were talking to the reader directly. They were referring to the fact that it was a book. They were referring to like subsequent pages. They were completely self-conscious in a way that like absolutely outstrips someone like Paul Auster, even from the very beginning, which we don't think of because we have this like received history which is impoverished, if you ask me.
Yeah, just to line up. I mean, I'm sure it's been done a million times, lining up the history of visual representation and literary representation. Clearly, that's been done. People, I imagine that they're continually borrowing from another, or not, but.
Book culture in the UK is really weird, and I sometimes teeter on the edge of conspiracy theory when I try and work out why the hell why. It's completely unique when placed in comparison with, I mean, not just with like places like France, which, and we know that France are better at that stuff than we are, but with places like America, it's astonishing. I mean, the particular area that I did my research on is this thing of British experimental fiction in the 60s. In America, the writers, their equivalent writers, the kind of like literary cousins of the people that I think about, are like kind of like lauded professors of creative writing at like the highest institutions. They're living in like ranches. They've got that. They're extremely comfortable. They're kind of like they have this like high position in culture. Over here, the writers who are the English equivalents. Mostly commit suicide, actually, or are living in complete obscurity. And so, book culture in the UK is a weird one, and I think other visual art and music and film have these kind of cross currents. There's a kind of like border that book culture has erected around itself in a way, which is my feeling, but then I'm paranoid.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about the dialogue and actually being invited, kind of, that you feel that you become invited into the
outside. Yeah, I love it. I have a context.
I'm quite interested in kind of like really interested in things like this and kind of the conversations and the dialogue, and that you said kind of you felt maybe it's like, what is the book culture or the book world kind of doing wrong, and do you feel like there is that kind of level of criticality just within, say, more stereotypical kind of literature, book culture around the work that you're interested in, or do you think...
What do you mean by criticality?
I mean like kind of, I don't know, just like discussion and debate and kind of always looking to kind of, yeah, what's the new thing or kind of sharing that.
I think the commonly held view in like kind of sort of pseudo like mainstream book culture in the UK is always a kind of like disavowal of the new. I mean, it's become almost mythic. The idea that you know, well, the novel's been dying since it began, but especially like since the 60s or so. The idea where nothing's doing, it's all crap, we're all screwed. Like, you know, that's it, just on and on and on. That's all that book culture sort of says to itself. Sorry, I'm a bit doomy about book culture. Sorry, guys.
It's really interesting.
Picking up on that doomy thing, I don't want to misquote, but I have a book of a Manchester-based artist talked in relation to arts, kind of interest in art as kind of contemporary arts, sort of, use this word, sort of fetishism, fetishizing of something redundant. Mm-hmm.
I mean that this is part of my misgivings about the kind of like fuss that's made of some of writers these days who display any kind of like experimental like tiny little tendency. It's this fetishization of something that's obviously redundant. This idea of calling someone that uses slightly weird literary language an avant-garde writer, when the term avant-garde is like, can we even use it anymore? I mean, and the idea of applying it now is so redundant and so absurd, but they become fetishized, I think, in the way that you mentioned, yeah.
This fetishizing, I mean, I think it's fascinating the way that writers' studios and artists' studios are often recreated after they've died, or the Francis Bacon studio was meticulously, every page was photographed, the dust was moved to a new location, it's been in Dublin. But this fetishizing of the I think I'm changing the subject a bit, I don't mean to pull it away, but really focuses in on that moment of the writing, the process of the writing, what it was like, what he looked at when he was writing, and it was usually he. And I think this kind of cementing down, pinning down of exactly what the studio looked like, or the writing house looked like, what the location was like in the space where the writing was done, I find it very interesting. Just because you talk about this, the kind of fetishizing and the...
Yeah. Well, there's such a mystique even now surrounding, like, I mean, you know, the Guardian run that picture every week. Do they still do it, where it's like a writer's room and you see Will Self's like post-it notes and stuff, and everyone's like, will this give me the key to writing a bestseller? But it's an attempt to sort of puncture a mystique to try and rationalise it, to say, what is it that writers do? In fact, I did an interview with a writer called Jim Crace recently. Anyone know Jim Crace? No. Jim Crace, interesting chap, literary Darwinist, problematic, but he refuses to talk about his like process of writing. He claims that like he sits at his desk at 9 a.m, something happens, a narrative genie comes, and it just sort of pours out, it's just like a conduit, and then he walks away again at 5 o'clock, and doesn't think about it anymore. You know, he's not like one of those writers who's like sitting in the bath thinking about the sentence structure and stuff. And it's really interesting to me because he's absolutely sort of kind of, he's an ultra-rationalist guy, but he's completely bought into like the narrative mystique, the idea that it's like hardwired into us all, you just have to summon this genie and narrative just comes out. Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Weird.
You have the text and then you have the stuff that goes around it, the mystique that goes around the authors.
Mm. But even though we all live in our external worlds, we exist in our internal worlds.
Yes, it was slightly, going back to Alan Rowland's contribution to the religion, which actually annoyed me quite a lot with his hunter-gatherer approach. but he was looking at the relationship between the writer or artist or producer and the audience receiver, spectator. And it seems to me that fiction, experimental fiction, is about sort of breaking down the notion that there is a thing which you then read. It's about drawing the reader into the creation of the work. And that's a parallel process with art and other sorts of things. And I suppose it's that relationship that it makes it very difficult for the reader, or spectator. You have to work, and it's problematic. And it also challenges the market, in a sense, because a book is no longer a book, it's something else that's happening. So that's just some random thoughts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone else have any kind of response to Alan's piece, as that's really nice of kind of bringing that back, all of those letters? Anything interesting
about that? There's an interesting kind of bristling current in some of the choices, especially the J.D. Salinger bits. And that kind of that implies a strange dynamic as well between the invitation to contribute and the response, which is obviously you send the invitation out to him, he's responded, and then the kind of end product of that has been this dialogue, which is kind of bringing in, yeah, this slightly bristling element, which is kind of really interesting, I think. It's almost like a little thistle in the salad.
It's kind of like it's playing with, it makes me feel like where is he in this? Like, I like that because he's kind of recreating other people's letters and bringing different elements into it, and it's kind of like it's not using that as a quote to say this is what I think when you use those words. Just kind of like where is the voice and what is the purpose of the writing? The demo sentence hasn't been written a lot of it, but it's kind of like, I don't know, it's not to communicate anything, it's just to kind of speculate or insert something or
you can
think something.
I
thought it was interesting in sort of contrast to the other words, which were more about sort of a certain type of physicality being involved. That was far more, and Phil and quite stirred from places. partly because it sort of like seemed to be floating around a lot more, even though it came from sort of, it was quotes but not quotes, as it were. And I thought that was an interesting contrast in the other words.
And it's kind of a bit diaphanous, it's like it's the only way anyone apart from or experienced it is as spoken words, and spoken words which aren't our words or his words, but they're kind of curated by him. So yeah, it's a kind of ephemeral thing.
That's the position of the curator rather than the maker.
Maybe
the
it's a work, it's a kind of performance that he's done and he's used. Something that is written in a writing out loud or a potential work of fiction, which is a text that will just make sure we have permission to circulate. And he also sent this with his so he's going to try and sort of make a draw on it, but it's a pretty huge thing. So
what
he's presenting
a performer, isn't it? Performer 9, so it's pre existing work. But,
and it just sort of struck me in terms of something that Jamie was saying in terms of like mediating information. He says, every written work can be regarded as a prologue, or rather the broken cast of a work never penned, and destined to remain so because later works, which in turn will be the prologues or the moulds for other absent works, represent only sketches or death masks. So it's kind of this thing that nothing's ever really finished on, and it's just a constant kind of process of working through. I love the rest of what you're saying about entering the work.
And that applies to the writing as well as the reading, doesn't it? Because something can be written and never really finished, or it can be written and never really read as well. So I mean, the bit that I read, you know, the zoo bit, he's talking about what happens when a letter is never sent. So there's different kinds of stopping points, aren't there, for a text? You can stop a text. I mean, like my scribbly, you know, the thing where I was drawing, I didn't really want to keep the end scribble. That wasn't the point, it was just the process.
Oh, but you have got the edit program.
No, I haven't.
You have?
Well, I mean, it's, you can pause it at the end, but the video ends and it goes, and I've screwed up the paste papers in the bin, so for all intents and purposes.
So what substance?
Sorry?
So the substance is gone.
Yeah. And it's actually, it's true, it's kind of awkward, and maybe I should cut the video as soon as the last pen goes off the stage, because it's like all of the, I mean, you could divide writing up into the process of writing and the kind of awkward remainder of the writing process, which doesn't show the time spent crossing out. It doesn't even show the bits that are crossed out, because they actually get deleted and removed. So that they're very, very different animals, aren't they? Although they kind of have a really close bond, which just makes everything awkward because they're so different, but they're kind of...
That reminded me of an essay I read recently. I can't remember who it's by. It's by a New York art critic talking about this exhibition in the mid-70s of performance objects. Mm-hmm. So they've got, like, Laurie Anderson props. They've got various, like, objects, remainders, kind of... documentation, but not really documentation, of performances by a lot of different artists, and the critic is saying how strange it is to see it presented as a show, because it's just remnants, and he says it's like doing a theatre show of just props. but then I read that, it's like, yes, it is!
There's an idea.
That's exactly like,
yeah.
Reading that kind of was interesting for me, because that's my orientation of like, I like the idea of the props with no action, which is kind of the other side of some of the stuff you're doing.
It's like you said, you had this script that hadn't been acted.
Yeah.
Was the script actually written?
Yeah, and the new one I've written I really like, but
it's not
going
the Chisenhale, you know Janice Kerbel's work at the Chisenhale Gallery, she recently did, I don't know if anyone saw it, a play for stage lights, which was, she wrote a script. But it was just the lights changing as they would have done if this play had been being played. But in the end, I think that was the idea as it started, but as she worked through, she eventually made it so that the play, the lights really were the characters, and she was trying to think of what kind of a plot would suit lights, you know, what kind of thing. So I think she had the lights softening and things like that.
Yeah.
But she had a script.
Yeah.
And she didn't particularly, she wasn't interested in showing anyone the script, because it really wasn't, that wasn't the point, but she didn't need a script to work from with actual words and feelings and situations, but for lights.
I mean that's definitely similar to how I've approached it. But yeah, it's interesting the way the actual experience of time spent with the work changes that. Like you kind of start with a position and an intent of like, I'm going to do this and it's going to be like this. These lights are going to be in these very specific places. And then again, it's the thing of spending time with the work where things start to change and diversify. And that's something I've only really felt over the past year, where you can actually spend time with a work and have this experience. It's like when you were talking about time and writing and trying to kind of find a parallel between the time spent writing and the time in narrative, which is really strange. And I had a really significant experience of it recently when I finished In Search of Lost Time by Proust, and I had this.
You finished it?
Yeah, I'm rereading it.
Forever. Round and round and round.
But finishing that was, first of all, I was like crying loads. Partly because I'd also like broken up with someone, but it was really, really emotional. But it was when you get to the end of that book and suddenly it starts linking back to these things which you read in the first book, and you realise it's not just a kind of abstract narrative time. You actually read the first book 2 or 3 years ago, and suddenly there's the experience of narrative time and lived time meets, and it's really...
See, it's all interest in Shandy, right there, 18th century, right there. If you're interested in... Props Without Players, I've totally gone author for you. Do you know Alan Rob Greer?
Yes.
Oh, you've already got him. Yeah. Because it seems to me that like a lot of these things that you're talking about, these artworks with a kind of like narrative sensibility in a way, but screwing with narrative. All these people seem to be absolutely indebted to yeah. Alan Robb-Grier's work, right? He must be like he's like the new thing.
Yeah. He's, very much, he's on all the.
Is he trendy?
He's trendy.
Okay.
We've got our own local example of that, the ill-fated pop museum.
Yeah.
The road, yes. Which is exactly that props without words,
yeah.
Without performance.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons it failed was nobody worked out what the role of the spectator
was. Yeah. God, I remember going there on a school trip and being like, what is this? Like, even at like 13, it didn't make sense to me. Yeah.
But it's true. It's the problem with the spectators. I mean, if you, the props without audience, fetishizing props without performances, fetishizing the leftover props. Mm-hmm. Likewise, you're fetishizing the leftover studios, the leftover. And if you take keeping the text and publishing the text as fetishizing the moment of writing, I mean, that's going a bit far because you write for the purpose of having the leftover text. But there is you could twist it around and think of it in that way. But if you do think of it in that way, then you have got a problem with the reader. The reader can't. You are the only person who's present in the text at the point of the writing.
You thought the author was dead.
Sorry?
You thought the author was dead.
Well, that's another brunch conversation. So then, yeah.
And then you have to think about whether you want to satisfy your readers or not, whether you want to satisfy your readers, or what's the dynamic of being unsatisfying for someone.
Because there's literally nothing. If I sit in my room and I'm having a moment writing, you know, if I'm doing a piece of writing, but I know that I'm not keeping the text, is that just part of my process? Is that an interesting process that develops into work? I mean, then you end up with the Alan Kaprow situation of artwork that is so not performed, or a private performance between two people, or experience with one person. Then you have the problem that he then has a huge retrospective in all the big galleries that have his performance props, describe his events, and the materiality of it is fetishized, it's all typewritten. So then you've got all these leftovers, but which really just defers the problem of the fact that he was trying to make work that was immaterial, which is the same kind of, you know.
It's quite interesting in terms of this exhibition as well, because we did talk about ephemera and things around work, and that there was a sense in the discussion last week that sometimes the ephemera can become quite encroaching on the work, or can become almost, become the work.
Yeah.
So a lot of things on this shelf are kind of more ephemera associated with Coracle, I guess, and they're interested in producing ephemera as well as producing books. And I found that really interesting, especially because I'm really fascinated by these vitrines, and that's my own art going on I'm going to probably create some work about that, is that these items you are allowed to handle because they're the ephemera. So in this respect, these are the more precious items in the vitrines, but these, I guess, they're still like the work of Coracle, but they are there to be, you can touch them, because I guess there's more of them, and I'm quite interested in that kind of, just the amount and the kind of quantity that you create depend on whether it gets fetishized or not. And actually, if you make something like a video, I guess, or if you can make something really accessible and really available, then it's less likely for that to happen. And that seems really key, especially with publishing and kind of big publishers and art publishers.
Mm.
You know, if you're going through a kind of mainstream big publisher, you're producing thousands and thousands of copies, so therefore value less than if you're with specialised art.
And there's a difference in the quality of the text, in the sense that with a musical score, the score is not the work, the performance is the work.
Yeah.
With a mass-produced anything text, every single text is on a part. They're all the text. They are the work. There is no special version of it. I mean, you could contrive special versions. I'm sure J.K. Rowling does these kind of, you know. Whereas with limited edition books, I don't know. There's a different relationship, isn't it? Because they are, again, the work, but I'm not sure.
Does anybody else have any other questions that they have been holding me to, or complete other areas? Do you feel free to throw in complete other area in response?
I have just something that's kind of like just related to what you say about scores and work. This is a typical, perhaps it's a tangent, but something to do with the production, the product of the work. the Cat Pro show and performance document or performance prop. Well, like in a way, that was, so when putting this exhibition together, that was a lot of what I was thinking about, because initially it was proposed just as just the books, and that would have been one thing. But for me, what I really think, I get pitched a lot of, being a gallery, producing books, and there's a lot of traumatic conversations around whether or not to produce a book or not as part of the project, and sometimes it's quite hard because you know what is, we have produced some things which I know will have a readership of about 25, and but actually the cost of producing 25 books is more or less the same as the cost of producing 1,000. And you know, there's a lot of complexities in that. Decisions, but in terms of what we're trying to do with this show and bringing Joanna and Charlotte in as copy in residence was exactly like, in a sense, the Capro show is that good art tends to be something that's in dialogue through long time, not just through short time. So the Capro show being a series of documents and performance objects, in a sense, it's not just those things, it's bringing some kind of collective memory into play. And I think that's what, in a sense, these books is some kind of bringing a collective memory into play. However, memory is not necessarily very helpful unless it's being re-remembered.
Right.
And so there's something about bringing in Charlotte and Joanna, who have bringing whole different kinds of debates, whole different kinds of discussions to play off a memory that exists in somebody else's head. And so that's, for me, there is a value in showing performance objects and performance documents, even if most of your experience is one of alienation, because you weren't there, and you can't remember. And as much as someone can give you second-hand reading of what happened, that even in itself serves to exclude you further.
Yeah.
And so there's that sense of different layers of it, and then whether or not it's still, I suppose, history making is about deciding that some things, despite the fact we're excluded from them, are relevant for us to go and try and make contact with, despite our alienation from them.
And it's all, there's also an element of the kind of myth making of not being there for the experience, but seeing the leftovers, seeing the remainders, and it's that thing where it kind of starts generating different narratives that, involve the quality of not being there, involve the quality of missing out on the kind of immediate encounter. So a new encounter is generated. And
it's kind of, I'm going back to what Charlotte was, because there is this sort of third kind of thing, because you've got the script and the score which demand an action. You've also got the book, which is very much something that goes on inside your head, and the action is the action of reading it. And then you've got the leftover remnants of stuff that's just been left around the place.
And also like oral histories and anecdote that sense of a legacy that's built through collective memories, conversations, discussions, which kind of has its own influence on things and works and experiences.
Yeah, it's interesting from the point of view of publishing kind of literary texts. The press that I work for is an archive press, so they kind of like, well, in amongst doing fiction translations, well, they look back over literary history, decide what needs picking out, and republish it. And because they're sort of funded by various endowments and donors and allied to a US university, they don't have to worry about the market. So it's an incredible position to be in. But it's also like an incredible position of responsibility, and rather weird to think of my boss, the publisher, going, this is what deserves to be rescued, you know? Yeah. And we do encounter people sometimes that say that it's unethical to rescue things that the market has already passed judgment on. The market's passed judgment, it's been lost, lost to posterity, why should it come back? Or that the idea of trying to rescue things is, ethical in and of itself, but we should better kind of redirect our attention to the process by which these things got lost in the first place, rather than, you know, there's an argument made by Franco Moretti that says, you know, if we're thinking about lost books, what does one matter? Wouldn't it be better to sort of think about this whole system that means that these books are lost? There's no point in rescuing one. So it's interesting to think about the idea of having an archive press and having this jurisdiction over literary history, and also in regards to translation. Also, the publisher has a tremendous amount of jurisdiction over what gets translated into English. So we have like the Slovakian Arts Council coming to us, and for once, the publisher is sort of important because they need our help, and having that work translated into English is hugely significant. So it's a funny position to be in. We have jurisdiction over history and also language.
And access to language.
Mental, yeah.
Can I throw in one really short thought, because I've been dying to, just following up on your description of Alan Kaprowes and these works as being necessary things to help you access something that would otherwise be forgotten, but they're also a barrier because they point out that you weren't really there. Mm. In a way, that's really what writing is, a barrier to the fact that you weren't there when it was written, in a funny sense. I just grabbed this book because this anthropologist does these field drawings and he prefers to draw rather than write. Michael Tassi, because he says that writing has this tendency to kill everything. You suck it down into writing, then it's gone, whereas drawing somehow. So yes, maybe objects do that even less.
And in that kind of questioning, like, the moment of writing is lost in the encounter, and kind of maybe that is like to draw on what you said earlier about this is the thing where these disciplines meet. It does seem to be, in negotiating that relationship with the reader or